This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
So I guess I'm part of a conversation going on in Canada and the U.S. and around the world as to what's green these days. What is in the interests of the commonweal?
We all know the creatures of the earth are in dire straits. Billions of humans, more tens of billions of our food animals, all slashing down the landscape, denuding the oceans, and polluting the atmosphere. Unless we can make a drastic change, the climate is headed for a catastrophic shift. Are we ready for desperate measures? Stuart Brand became a household name in the 1970s with his Whole Earth Catalog, the tool that connected it to do-it-yourself energy and back-to-the-land implements for an alternative culture. Now he's back with friends in high places and a big business frame of mind. Brand is promoting his new book, Whole Earth Discipline, an Eco-Pragmatist Manifesto, now in an updated paperback edition. I caught up with Stuart at the Gaining Ground Conference in Vancouver. About 14 people showed up. It became an opportunity for a unique conversation with one of the plugged-in minds of our times. As Stuart Brand roved about the room, thought, and answered, I recorded with a mini-disc shoved in his pocket. Some of the participants did not expect to be on radio. I've replaced their questions with computer-generated voices. Sorry, that's the way it goes. Except for my own voice, of course. I present Stuart Brand and eco-pragmatism as one set of solutions. He wants geoengineering, like powdering the clouds with sulfates. Thinks the world needs genetically engineered food. Says nuclear power is required to avert catastrophic climate change. He wonders if the power of well-meaning billionaires might sidestep the failure of politics. These are not my positions. You be the judge. Here is a conversation with Stuart Brand, recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock on October 5th, 2010, in Vancouver, Canada.
I gave a presentation last night, and I'm going to give another one tonight. And so this is not a presentation. This is a conversation. And just out in paperback, this book largely deals with, I'm a lifelong environmentalist who is lately trying to see what green means in this century as opposed to back in the 1970s when the so-called modern environmental movement was pretty much invented in response to the images of Earth from space that we got from 1969 on. The approach I'm taking is that we're in a different situation. We know different things about climate now than we did then. We have vastly more sophisticated technologies for energy and other things. On the other hand, biotech is better. Energy, solar and wind have become important. We're learning things about the downside as well as the upside of those. Nuclear technology is matured and moving on. And prospects of geoengineering, of direct intervention in the climate, is something that is now being contemplated that was unimaginable back in the 1970s. And we've learned a lot more about restoring wildlands, which is a major interest I have. So I guess I'm part of a conversation going on in Canada and the U.S. and around the world as to what's green these days. What is in the interests of the commonweal? What is the common good that can be maintained for the longest time with the tools we have to hand, and that's our discussion. So what would you guys like to talk about?
I'm interested in the interim to the solutions that you talked about last night that you can see coming down the road, perhaps decades away. Just the general wacko factor as things collapse and politics get strange. With all the technology we potentially have, I have a thing on my shoulder that says yeah, but politics and madness, what are some of the roadblocks and challenges due to the chaotic nature of the world in general?
I think this is a great question to ask. You know, how does the political aspects of all this play out? The science is, you know, the scientific argument is moving forward. We're getting better and better data. We're getting better and better models about climate, about all these things. People are still understanding that science is an argument. And scientists are still understanding that politics is an argument. They were astounded to find that once they said, hey, we've got to mitigate greenhouse gases, please do it as quickly as possible. And for a large amount of time, the political argument is, you don't know what you're talking about, or you do know what you're talking about, but you're wrong, or there's some kind of plot that you're actually operating in the agenda of, and scientists are going, say what? I've just given you the facts, now act on them. And that's not the way the political debate goes forward. And it's not the pace at which the political debate goes forward. And every time the political debate hears about action in the scientific debate, the political debate, in a sense, gets exacerbated because some people are saying, well, if the scientists don't agree, why should we act? And is there any reason to think the political debate will come to some kind of enough of a completion for things to actually move forward at the pace at which crisis seems to be emerging in terms of climate and everything else? Extrapolating from right now, probably not. Take the worst case, the hardest case. The hardest case is geoengineering. Enough of the world agreeing that we have to do something direct about climate and put sulfur dioxide, pretend to be a volcano, put sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere and cool the planet directly, just the way Mount Pinatubo did in 1991. The litigation alone suggests that no way you get international agreement about that. The other major problem there that people see is that the cost of doing that, of putting sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere like a volcano, is maybe as low as $300 million a year to cool the planet by 3 degrees Celsius. Well, there's probably people in Vancouver who can afford to do that. There's certainly a lot of nations that can afford to do that. And so what's talked about, the idea of unilateral geoengineering, is the new kind of bete noire that many people have, that this could be very scary. So you need international agreements. There is no UN law that has now been determined by people looking at this that covers this. The question is whether the United Nations would even be, you know, an adequate entity to handle it. And so it could well be that we get to a case where the climate is running away. Everybody knows it's running away. We're having typhoons and droughts and all the stuff that was warned about. And a lot of people are saying, oh my God, we've got to do Plan B, geoengineering, to buy time in order to mitigate greenhouse gases. And enough people understand that has to happen, but not enough people understand that has to happen to get international agreements that all the people downwind of each other, which is everybody when you're talking about a global climate. And it could well be we disagree ourselves to death. And then there's feedbacks in that, such that once you get serious droughts going on, once you get, say, the rivers of Asia that are fed by the glaciers of the Himalayan plateau, when they dry up in the summer, and now what the Mekong goes to, I think, six nations, not many of whom like each other, and the guys downstream, we're already seeing this in some areas, in the Mekong as well, and somewhat in the Indus. The people downstream get deprived of water by the guys upstream, and they fight over it. Once that fighting starts at a global scale, people taking sides and all the rest of it, then how do you get agreement of any sort about geoengineering or anything else? So the worst case is pretty bad, and the best cases are none too good. So a whole lot of how this stuff moves forward, I think your question raises, and we'll pursue it, is how does this play out politically?
Do you believe that society has advanced at the same pace as the technology? Have people changed significantly?
They keep saying the human nature hasn't changed much since at least the Greeks. So we read the Greek tragedies and feel right at home with the problems being presented there. If a modern Oedipus marries his mother, we'd be just as alarmed probably as they were. Society is made of communication. And communication technology has changed so enormously that a whole lot of people are tweeting a whole lot of people simultaneously or maintaining a kind of friendship that never existed before, friending on Facebook, are asynchronously communicating through email, are cell phoning. Cell phones took off so rapidly, the poorest people in the world have them and are using them to get out of poverty. So there's no change in human nature involved there, but the nature of human activity has. And democracy was invented and reinvented before we had these things. And so group decision making is probably going to go through a couple of transformations in the next couple of decades, and maybe driven by things like the very issue of how do we agree enough globally to take global action in relation to global problems. The last time we did that, it was done by governments. That was the Cold War. And basically, behind vast barriers of secrecy, the Soviet Union and the United States managed to keep the Cold War cold. And we, the people, didn't have much say in that. This time, the governments have a huge play, much more than I used to think in libertarian Whole Earth Catalog days. They had value. But now they have to do things like make coal expensive and do other things to seriously mitigate greenhouse gases in the long term and maybe take these kind of actions in the short term. I don't think we need to change human nature. If we need it, we could do that with drugs, but I don't think it's necessarily going to happen. But if the nature of communication changes enough and we adapt to getting the best value from it enough, like there's a shot. All of this is there's just a shot. I mean, the default case is James Lovelock describes just actually this afternoon, since I generated a slide, I might as well use it, what we're looking at. This is a restoration project. We're trying to restore climate to what it has been for the last 10,000 years. Civilization has never known anything other than a pretty benign long summer, as it's called. And so one choice is business as usual. And it gets about, James Lovelock's version is, it goes about 5 degrees Celsius warmer than we have now over a period of a few decades, maybe a century. That has a carrying capacity for maybe a billion, billion and a half people. The tropical areas, the rainforest dies. All the species in them die. Those parts of the world become basically uninhabitable, and everybody moves to Vancouver. It's easier for the northern hemisphere because, as you may have noticed, the landmass is mostly in the northern hemisphere, and the continents tend to narrow in the southern hemisphere. So as things get warmer and drier and people head toward the poles, there's more in the north than there is in the south. That's not a world you really want. So the restoration we would like to see is to maintain something like we've had. You've heard about the medieval hot spell, that's it right there, and the so-called ice age around 1600 is there. So within that range, pretty good at keeping civilization going. That's the problem set for this century. Even doing the science properly to some extent depends on good, better politics. We need to be doing the science now on geoengineering, start testing at scale some of the various half dozen schemes that are out there. Some environmentalists, Environmental Defense Fund is now, in the U.S., is now sponsoring research into geoengineering. That's unimaginable 10 or 15 years ago that any environmental organization would suggest tampering with Gaia, playing God, defying nature, all those bad things we're not supposed to do if we're good greens. They're stepping up to the scale of the problem. And not everybody's done that, not everybody will. But all you need is rough consensus and running code, as they say in the Internet Engineering Task Force, to have at least the research go forward. To then to deploy these kinds of technologies takes more than rough consensus. It takes real agreement.
On your graph, you project a downturn in the temperature. What is that based on? Is it due to technological change or behavioral change?
Yeah, everything. Lots of wind, lots of solar, lots of nuclear. Maybe some geoengineering to sort of buy time, because this is actually on the order of a century right here. What you worry about is going across tipping points that even though you start to mitigate a little better, it's already too late and you're firing into the oceans. The Lovelock version of this is that basically the oceans stop running the atmosphere. They stratify and basically die because they get too warm, as they did 55 million years ago. And then the continents take over. And the continents would run a warmer Gaia. At least that's what happened back in the Eocene. Whatever it is, transition, when it really was a lot warmer. There are crocodiles in the polar ocean.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are listening to an intimate afternoon with Stuart Brand, author of Whole Earth Discipline, an Eco-Pragmatist Manifesto.
What is the cause? Not of just CO2, but the fundamental cause of the environmental damage.
Early success happens a lot in biology. I was trained in ecology way back when, so it's been great fun having to catch up on what's going on in the science in the last 50 years. Big boom, semi-bust. is the mode with any invasive species, and we're the world's greatest invasive species ever. So you come into an area like North America and leave a bloody trail. And we killed all the megafauna and started burning the place, and then once the Europeans showed up, well, actually, there was a lot of agriculture going on before the Europeans got here, and then a lot more once we did, plus diseases and, you know, things going back and forth. And then things settled down. So we're, in a sense, what I think we're in the midst of is an invasive species that is settling down. We've run out of continents to invade. We're not actually expanding anything like the rate we used to. We will probably top out, certainly below, to my eye, 9 billion by mid-century, maybe as low as 8 billion by mid-century, and then drop rapidly because of, as a guy named Hazeltine put it once, independent of culture everywhere in the world, as soon as women get economic independence, they stop reproducing our species. And fertility rate is below replacement, 2.1 children per woman, in over half the countries in the world now. It's quite low in some places. Italy has 1.3 children per woman. Brazil has 1.3 children per woman. At that rate, you basically half your population in 45 years. If you keep that rate, then you half the population again in the next 45 years. So you're talking about within one century going to a quarter of what you had before. Japan and Russia are already losing population. So the sense I have is that we've peaked anyway. And that's part of what makes this an interesting century, because we're going through the dealing with the harm we caused, becoming an enormous, overwhelmingly dominant species, to finding out how to blend in a little better. Plus, the success that we're having is less and less dependent on killing megafauna. In fact, we now have the capability of bringing back the mammoth and the mastodon and the saber-toothed tiger, which will probably be somewhat limited in its range. But we can do those things. We can bring back Neanderthals. This is now within the skill set that humans have. That's an amazing transition.
And behind that, why have humans risen to such dominance?
There's a book that's just now coming out by Kevin Kelly called What Technology Wants. It's the only predictive theory of history I've seen that actually works. And for technology, cities are technology. Sexual recombination is technology. Cells are technology. There is a trend that seems to have its own agenda of things getting more and more capable. Start with the stars and go on right through us to whatever's next. And we happen to, by virtue of, who knows, some event that happened in Africa, coming out of the trees and having hands available and the ability to make voices that became speech, that became writing, that became all this stuff, that gave us the ability to do cultural evolution drastically faster than biological evolution. Even the kind of biological evolution that microbes do, which is an hourly genetic engineering of passing genes among various species. So we were the ones that, luckily I guess, got endowed with the leading edge of the technological imperative and are still comprehending the responsibilities that entails. So that sense of responsibility is, I think, growing. The capability of acting on that responsibility is growing. But the realization takes a while. You know, when you're successful, the first thing that somebody who's getting really rich does is make a lot of mistakes. We're in that category. And we didn't have any, you know, imagine you were the first rich person. Here's the problem. Rich people who get rich now, they can look around and see people who've really blown it. They've distorted their kids. They've blown it all on drugs, the suicide within a decade, whatever it might be. It's because you can look around and see the ones doing it right and doing it wrong. And so a Warren Buffett and a Bill Gates can kind of inspire each other to be incredibly good and useful and helpful at being rich. And when we came along, there was nobody to, you know, who were we supposed to study? Porcupines? So we're having to invent, and this is Bill Gates' line, You know, we try a thing, we fall down, we stumble, we pick ourselves up, stumble along. And he says, it's a stumbling game. All you can hope for is that you're stumbling in the right direction. And I think we are getting a sense of direction.
My fear about genetics, it's being done mainly by one big company, Monsanto.
Used to be, not anymore, but go ahead.
And they went for ownership of seeds with Terminator seeds, and that created quite a scare. And the same could be said about nuclear. It takes great big companies or governments to do it. So I'm worried that the technologies and choices that you are advocating themselves lead toward, whether we want it or not, kind of a dictatorial format rather than a bottom-up series of solutions. How would you answer that?
I don't think it's either or. One of the things I've grown to be unhappy about with the environmental movement is that it went from being a right-wing thing, which it was back in the early part of the last century. When I gave my pledge as an American to save and faithfully to defend from waste the natural resources of my country, its air, soil, metals, its forests, waters, and wildlife back in 1952, I got that from Outdoor Life. It was a hunting and fishing magazine. And Teddy Roosevelt and duck hunters were the leading preservationists in the world. They were conservatives. And then it flipped. And remember, progress used to belong to progressives. And then somehow it flipped, and progressives got scared by progress. In a sense, you just stated a form of the progressive fear of progress, that it's being driven by a capitalist engine that they distrust, and sometimes with very good reason. Green came to mean left. And so anybody who didn't much like liberals, and there's plenty of reasons not to like liberals, then decided they were, if liberals were green, then if you're conservative, you have to be anti-green. So this weird flip happened. And so you have Republicans who can't take climate change seriously because Al Gore does. Gee, Christ, what a weird situation that is. So, I mean, I've talked to Al Gore, and my advice to him is please, please, please just tell the world that you are no longer any particular political party. You're an independent or worse, and you don't give a rat's ass what happens with the Democrats anymore, what happens with the Republicans. You've got a scientific case to make, and that's your life. If he did that, it would help a lot. A lot of people wouldn't believe him and say, you're just hiding your secret leftist agenda, but I think it would help. So I don't think corporations per se are any worse than nations. They're just a way that we organize activity. And so there's a lot of the leftist green perspective on things that says if it comes from a corporation like Monsanto, it is automatically bad. And you sort of say, well, you know, what if it comes from a corporation like Google? Well, they're suspect. they say don't be evil, but do they really mean it? Blah, blah, blah. I wish nuclear were less corporate in the U.S. I think Canada's had pretty good nuclear, partly because it has been such a basically national project. I'm glad it's basically a national project in China.
Like France.
Or France is the classic case. 80% of their electricity is nuclear, and no accidents, cleanest air in Europe. They're way ahead on greenhouse gas emissions of everybody, including green Denmark and green Germany, who's still mining coal and burning it like mad and so on. So that's kind of I don't care that much about corporations' perspective, but down to Monsanto and seeds. Right now, most of the cutting edge of transgenic crop development is happening, aided partly by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation for years, is happening in the developing world, where they really, really need these crops, because in the global north, wheat and corn have been bred to within just a few degrees of their fullest capability. This is not true of sorghum or cassava or even rice. And so there's vast improvements that can be made in the genes of these plants that most of humanity lives on and that are not seen as major markets by Monsanto or DuPont or Syngenta or the other gene giants. And they have been prevailed on by Rockefeller Foundation and others to lighten up on their patent protection so that they could go forward. I was reading the New York Times just now that Monsanto's stock is in trouble because its herbicide-tolerant Roundup Ready crops are getting competition from Chinese seeds that are developed completely outside their corporate world. So once again, we'll see if this is an area where China starts to threaten the people here by just doing what we do only better. So I think Monsanto was a problem for a while, not for the reasons that most Greens said. A lot of Greens said, well, Monsanto, the Terminator gene, what a terrible idea. One, it never was deployed. The idea was Monsanto was going to try to protect that it would sell you a fresh set of seeds every year. And that's the deal they make with the farmers. And some people ignore that and keep the seed and plant it year to year. Actually, most farmers don't do that. There's a world of growers and a world of breeders. And they're different sets of people. So few of the actual growers bother to breed. They just get new seeds every year. They're getting hybrids. Most of their seeds are hybrids, which you have to get every year anyway. But here was the thing which would breed true. And so Monsanto thought, well, let me just make it so that it's sterile. Now, there's a really good argument for sterile. A green argument is you don't want those corn seed, those corn pollen getting out and putting these capabilities into somebody else's corn, land-raised corn or whatever. And so us Greens have said, make sure that the pollen, that genetically engineered pollen, can't get around. Well, it's a perfect solution, just make it sterile, like a seedless grape or a banana or any of these other sterile crops that they use. And Monsanto, if they'd had half a brain, would have said, we've got the solution to your green problem. We've got these sterile corn crops we're going to sell now. What do you think of that? Instead, they said, we're going to protect our seeds and force these farmers to blah, blah, blah. So then the green argument became, oh, you're enslaving farmers. Has anybody ever tried to enslave a farmer?
Pretty difficult.
Yeah, it's like trying to enslave a fisherman. These are independent characters. And so the idea that Greens were going to give all these poor, ignorant farmers good advice on how to run their business and what relationship they have with their vendors has just been madness. And so every time genetic engineering comes up for a vote, we're going to have a GM-free county in Marin County and so on. The counties that are controlled by farmers always reject those proposals. So the farmer wants better seed. Everywhere in the world, a farmer wants better seed. The seed will lose stuff. That's why I was saying last night that one of the earliest and most effective adopters of BT corn, of pest-resistant corn, were the Amish. The Amish looked at it and said, does this threaten our community? That's what they look at every technology. Well, you, and you, try it, and the rest of us will watch. And often what they do is they'll see that phones or whatever it is does a certain amount of harm, and they'll back off three quarters of a turn. And they looked at what happened with BT, and this is sort of the, no. So widely adopted and early. I think the worry about Monsanto was unnecessary, unuseful in any way in the past. Because the technology, the use of the technology has just moved on. And it's going to move on much further. Every garden shed in Canada is going to have people doing biotech with their petunias. And just the way people breed stuff now to have wilder and crazier rutabagas, they'll use biotech to have wilder and crazier rutabagas. Then the biosecurity people get interested. And they're realizing that cat is out of that bag. And so what you now want is a populace that is as astute at understanding biotech problems as coders are at recognizing virus problems on the internet. And I guess that's part of my optimism as an organizer of the Hackers Conference back in 1983, that biohackers will be as good for civilization as computer hackers have been. What if I'm wrong? Well, mistakes will be made and they will be backed off from. This is why I encourage, along with the precautionary principle, which I think is fine so long as you always evoke it when there's actual evidence of harm, a vigilance principle of just keeping a close eye on absolutely everything, including the things you think are pretty safe, because we keep being surprised. But the vigilance principle says the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. So what you're being vigilant for is not only things that turn out to be a problem, but things that turn out to be good news, and then grab those and run with them. It's not all surprises or bad surprises. People are more surprised by good surprises, I think, than by anything. It's probably good. I'm sorry, I'm kind of ranting on it. What else do you want to talk about?
Isn't that a vivid mind? You are listening to Stuart Brand, founder and editor of the Whole Earth Catalog, now promoting a new kind of green. He calls it an eco-pragmatist manifesto. His ideas are shocking to many people. This is not my idea of environmentalism, but in these desperate times, perhaps the last times for a stable climate, we should listen to all ideas. This recording was made October 5th, 2010, in Vancouver.
The quote in your book, Whole Earth Discipline, saying the climate is going to get worse than we think, faster than we think. Can you expand on that?
I can expand on it by saying it might not be true. There's an afterword in this book. The paperback, you get to, the great thing about paperbacks is you get to come back and say, has anyone here actually spent any time with this book? Good. It relies a lot on James Lovelock, who's a friend for 30 or 40 years now. The Gaia Hypothesis guy in England has done several very good and scary books on Gaia in the last couple of years, basically saying the climate is moving fast and ferociously. They start you right off with things that are in the first chapter in the book itself deals with climate. So in this afterword, I'm kind of filling in what happened later. In December 2009, the book came out in October 2009. December 2009, the UN Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen was undermined by a suspiciously sophisticated hack of emails. Suspiciously sophisticated means a very expensive, very capable hack of emails. Somebody paid for that hack. Might have been China, might have been Russia, might have been the right wing in the US, who knows? Somebody did. Among climatologists at the University of East Anglia, England, once again, climate change deniers dominated the public discourse and prevented action on greenhouse gases. I responded with a New York Times op-ed titled Four Sides to Every Story, suggesting that it helps to distinguish four kinds of views about global warming according to whether they are driven mainly by ideology or by evidence. Denialists and skeptics, quotes, quotes, both have doubts about climate change, but only the science-based skeptics change their opinions with changing evidence. Likewise, ideological calamitists and scientific warners are alarmed about climate, but only the warners respond to contradictory evidence. James Lovelock, for example, a warner, has softened his sense of alarm about the pace of climate change. I mean, he is persuaded by a sensible skeptic, Garth Paltridge's book, The Climate Caper, that climate scientists have become overly politicized, and a paper in Science by Kevin Trenberth, head of climate analysis at the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research, led Lovelock to conclude that solar energy is coming in, but much of it is going to some unknown destination. Sea level rise continues to show the Earth is warming as expected, but the surface temperatures do not rise as they should. Something unknown appears to be slowing the rate of global warming. In the first chapter of this book, I emphasize the many unknowns in climate dynamics that could trigger abrupt climate change, positive feedbacks, and tipping points. Let me add further current unknowns in the climate system that might drive the pace of warming slower or faster than we expect. Trenberth and Lovelock is puzzled by the missing energy in the global net energy budget. Also, there is a large and mysterious sink of carbon that varies from year to year. That missing carbon might be absorbed by woody plants or by microbes in the oceans or soils. We don't know yet, so we don't know how to assist the process. Climatologist James Hansen deplores our lack of good data on aerosols, particles in the air, and thus the overall impact of global dimming is uncertain. The range of thoughts about global dimming is at 1, 2, 3 degrees Celsius. Cooling is happening because of basically coal dust and things like that. Well, that level of uncertainty, 1 to 3 degrees Celsius, is fierce. That we don't know means that the models are only so useful. We're not sure yet whether an increase in clouds has a negative or positive feedback effect. And the same goes for the added moisture in the air that warming brings. It all depends on research that remains to be done on altitude effects. In other words, the progress of climate science is likely to keep on alternately terrifying and mollifying us till mid-century at least. As Lovelock put it to me by email in May 2010, the plot thickens. We do not know when the heat will turn on. The missing energy. Downwelling would be intellectually satisfying, especially since it would probably require a corresponding upwelling of cold bottom water, which stays at 4 degrees Celsius in the lower parts of the ocean. It would help explain the current cool spell. The aerosols over East and South Asia could be a cause of global cooling. I discussed this in The Revenge of Gaia. The effects of clouds is difficult to distinguish from the aerosol effect. Increased biotic uptake seems unlikely, but could be an Arctic surprise as more cool, algal-rich water is exposed by the melting surface ice. Increased atmospheric moisture, especially in the upper troposphere and lower stratosphere, could have a large positive effect, positive feedback, making it worse, on heating. Do not forget that much of the water in the stratosphere comes from methane oxidation. Richard Betts from the Hadley Center was here yesterday and had the good news that their huge model that includes Gaia has just been turned on and after a year of tests and settling down should be giving results. Just that phrase, a year of tests and settling down, tells me something I didn't realize about models, which you don't just flip them on. There's a whole lot of tuning and figuring out and what are these excursions about and all the rest of it. Apart from a few friends like Richard Betts, my name is now mud in climate circles for having dared to consort with skeptics. Amazing how tribal scientists are. The take-home message is that it is now even more unwise for government to spend heavily on renewable energy and other green dreams. Use the gain in time to prepare for sensible adaptation. Could be worse, slower, faster, not at all. One place in the book I said, that climate has so many mysteries in it, it could have a hidden stabilization. But I think that would be the equivalent, counting on that would be the equivalent of playing Russian roulette with all of the chambers loaded, except maybe one. There's an online version of this book at sbnotes.com where I'm able to keep it from becoming quite as dated as nonfiction books usually do. sbnotes.com. Here. Book chapter looks like that. The online chapter looks like that with all of these live links and illustrations and oddments. My hope is that all nonfiction books will soon have online versions embedded in their own research. The idea is that you can go and do my research your own way and draw your own damn conclusions. All this book is a reflection of a certain amount of journalistic research.
There are a lot of tricky things about the media. It can be so hopeful, but then it can turn on you quickly. A fellow I used to work with in PR said, "It takes a ton of energy to get somebody out of their easy chair, but it takes the push of a little finger to get them back into it. I want to hear Lovelock changing his mind. I want to hear things aren't as bad. But there goes my impetus to get out of my easy chair and get involved. I try to keep both outcomes in mind and still move forward. Do people only act when they are scared?"
I think part of the thing we're still getting used to is the idea of uncertainty. In a sense, the fears of nuclear annihilation that I grew up with, we had a pretty good idea. We'd seen, the films and the bomb tests and the buildings blown away and all the rest of it. And we knew sort of how many warheads the Soviet guys had and they knew how many we had. And we felt helpless when the Cuban Missile Crisis was going on. I remember the feeling of, how come I don't get to actually have any say in this? And that was horrible. This one's different. Now the fears have to be based on not really knowing how how bad it might get, what the chances are of it getting that bad. Is greater uncertainty a reason to stay in the easy chair until you guys sort it out, or a reason to get out of the easy chair because some of the things that we're uncertain about are bloody frightening? And it raises, you know, can a person step up to helping reduce the uncertainty? And actually, they can. There's a lot of very distributed science going on. All the bird watchers know if the swallows are coming a little early to Capistrano because the climate has changed. And that amateur populist science is going forward, that we are getting a lot of data from a lot of people. There are a whole lot of people inventing schemes for saving energy, for making using cleaner sources of energy, for having cities like Vancouver that are even more compact and walkable and pleasant. And so you not only have a better world, you have a better city that you enjoy more. All these various win-win things, combinations, are developed by individuals and companies and sometimes by governments. So it is both a distributed problem set in the sense that we are all causers of excess greenhouse gases. They're coming out of our mouth and noses as we speak. This is carbon dioxide coming out. I'm sorry. So we're all the causes, but any solution set is going to be pretty distributed as well. It has to be. There is no single source. There's no tiny, finite set of sources of solutions here. They actually are as broadband as we can possibly do or imagine. So if we get through it, okay, humanity, sentient life, will have reason to pat itself on the back for having gotten through an adolescent suicidal period. Every post-adolescent should congratulate themselves for not having committed suicide. It looked like a swell idea at the time, and we got over it. What else?
The last I heard, Lovelock was saying, forget the mitigation spending. Put your money in adaptation. Is he still saying that?
Well, some mitigation. He likes nuclear, always has. You know, people are saying he's a convert like me, but he's not. His first career and his degree was in medicine. And so he worked with various forms of using radioactivity for diagnosis and for treatment. And so he's completely comfortable with that radiation is way less harmful than we imagine. We use it like mad in hospitals. And people worry about terrorists getting fissile material, radioactive material, to do dirty bombs or whatever with. They're not going to get it from any nuclear plants. If they really want it, they'll go steal it from hospitals. There's a lot more there. It's a lot more accessible. And I hope hospitals are taking the security. It's not that big a threat anyway. I've dealt with national security people, and the fear they have of a dirty bomb is not of the harm it does, but of the fear it causes. A radioactive device just went off at the corner of Nth and Nth in downtown Chicago. Freak out. The actual damage would be about a block and a half max. The damage to all of Chicago, of people going crazy, having abortions like they did around Chernobyl and so on, unnecessarily. That's the harm. So what I want there is a lot more knowledge of the kind that Lovelock has, that radiation is really common. The levels of reduced radiation that we require around nuclear sites are astronomically absurd. And as we found in medicine, radiation is our friend in many cases. Lovelock, what was the original question?
Mitigation, forget it. Adaptation.
He moved to a part of Devon that nobody was moving to when he moved there about 30, 40 years ago, and loves it. And, of course, they're talking about putting up windmills in his view shed, and he just hates it because I'm not sure people realize until they've lived with them how much windmills change the landscape that they're in. I'm sure back in Holland when they first got those big windmills going, the neighbors complained vociferously. The noise, the flashing thing all the time, the shadows, the sound, the traffic. And he rightly, there's a nice distinction that Bill Gates makes between what he calls energy farms and energy factories. Energy farms are wind farms and solar farms. because those two sources of energy are very dilute, you have to have a big footprint on the land, not just an ecological footprint, but an actual physical footprint, like 50 square miles for a gigawatt of solar and 250 square miles for a gigawatt of wind. A gigawatt is, you know, a normal coal-fired plant, a normal, relatively small nuclear-fired plant. That's a farm. And Gates says the energy factories use a much more compressed form of energy source, coal, or the really compressed form of energy source, which is nuclear fuel, or the astronomically compressed energy form, which is deuterium for fusion. And you've got a really small footprint on the land. I think Lovelock, as a environmentalist, really is responding to, do not make this big an impact on the landscape, which needs to be Gaian, which needs to be regular forest and ecological Gaian activities. Like all good ecologists, he also hates agriculture, wants it ferociously compressed. And it's one of the things I came out of in this book, is realizing that the sort of generalized design solution is to compress the deleterious things, compress the human deleteriousness into compact cities, compress the wild fishing that we do, overfishing the oceans, into good mariculture and good aquaculture, which is taking off worldwide. Compress your energy production into things like nuclear, and then the nuclear waste is tremendously concentrated. There's not very much of it. It's easily controlled, and if you decide you don't want it after a while, it's easy to stick in very stable parts of the ground and forget about it. So whereas coal waste goes in and fills everybody's atmosphere and cooks the world, I would love to see us cutting no more wild trees. Growing trees in plantations is a really effective way to get what you want from trees, whether it's pulp or plywood or lumber, and let the wild trees go and do their Gaian thing, and we can stroll amongst them. In Australia, I make a beef in the book about, there's the tallest hardwood in the world, it's called Eucalyptus regnans, 300 feet high. Gorgeous trees in Tasmania. Some of them are protected. Most of them are being cut down and chipped for cardboard. I can't imagine. It's like breaking up a Stradivarius violin to make firewood kindling. And we don't need to do that for cardboard. So concentrate these things, and I think that's the sort of thing that Lovelock is referring to, is stay away from some of the really dilute landscape tearing up forms of agriculture and energy farming. Food farming and energy farming, I guess, is the way to combine them. Lovelock is 90 years old, terrifyingly sharp. I've seen him at a table full of climatologists who respect him hugely. He gets standing ovations when he talks to scientists. And he's sort of sitting there quietly, a little stooped. And the conversation is flying among all these young climatologists. And they're sort of tolerating this old geezer's presence at the dinner table. And then he looks up and raises a question. And the whole conversation rears, because he's gone to a core issue. And he's not only got a perspective on it, he's got a lot of very current knowledge on it that often the other guys at the table don't have. So I'll keep listening to him so long as that's the case. What else? Your turn now.
As far as nuclear power goes, if I could use the analogy of the financial system right now, we've borrowed from the next generation. That's our plan. We're going to have the next generation or two pay back our debt or our national debt. And now we're going to put our nuclear waste for many, many generations to look after, even though civilizations, as I'm sure you know, don't last more than a couple of thousand years at best. We're counting on this one to last much longer, to look after this waste. How do you deal with that?
One of the reasons I got to change my mind on nuclear was I'm a co-founder of an organization called Global Business Network, and we do scenario planning, strategic thinking, long-term stuff. Long-term in business means longer than the next quarter. So to get a corporation to think 10 years out or 25 years out is a big step for them, a scenario planning steps up to that. I much prefer working for the military because they're comfortable in thinking 50 years out. Well, Canada's Nuclear Waste Management Organization invited us to come and help them think 10,000 years out. And one of the things we learned is scenarios don't work as a productive, rigorous way to think ahead over that kind of time frame. Basically, more than 50-year scenarios start to break up because things that you... It's an interesting logical problem. Scenarios, usually you come up with something like four different ways the world might go, four different theories of the world in the period of time you're thinking about. And you want your company or your government or your technology to bear in mind these different ways the world might go. There's a limitation that scenarios have, which is that they have to be plausible. Otherwise, nobody will act on them. Reality does not have this constraint. And so when you reach out more than 50 years into the past or more than 50 years into the future, the major effects of that world will be black swans of one sort or another. Things that were considered impossible at the time that turned out to have come out of left field, out of the blue, smack everything sideways, and it's way different than you thought. Well, that's interesting. So we're not going to do scenarios. The Nuclear Waste Management Organization, you may remember, I guess Parliament sort of started to pass some laws about all this stuff, and the Canadian people rose up and said, just a damn minute, we'd like to participate in this discussion, and don't you go deciding what's going to happen with nuclear waste without our involvement. So 60 hearings or something were held across the country. And I was involved in one of them, and naturally First Nations people were invited. They came along and said, well, and our brothers the Iroquois say it's good to think seven generations into the future. And so the calculations were done, and the number 175 years, which is a standard generation in anthropology, was taken as a time frame to take responsibility for this nuclear waste. Because, one thing, in 175 years, the nuclear waste, the radioactivity of the nuclear waste is reduced to 1/100,000th of what it was in seven generations. So you're already talking about the major part of the issue. The rest of the realization was the future has capabilities and skills and desires and the desire for options that we don't have. And so if we were, for to example, say, once through can-do style nuclear waste, we're done with it now, we're going to stick it in the ground, you take it up to the Laurentian Shield, bury it deep, and forget about it. That may be the richest source of fuel we could possibly have for the next generation reactors, integral fast reactors, fourth generation reactors. If we buried it down a deep hole in the Laurentian Shield, we'll feel like idiots. So let's either leave it where it is in dry cast storage out back of the parking lot at the reactor sites, or move it to some kind of interim storage place where we feel like it's safe and out of the way. But we can get at it if we decide we want to use it for something, because one generation's waste is another generation's fuel. And we never got into the Yucca Mountain argument in Canada. 10,000 years went out of the conversation because the realizations are the thing you always want to do for future generations is give them options, not reduce their options. And so this nuclear fuel, the realization was that the spent fuel could be easily buried. That technical problem has long been solved. And in the U.S., we've been burying this stuff for 10 years in salt formation underneath the New Mexican desert. That has been where it is for 250 million years. It's not going anywhere. Water can't get into it or out of it. Put the stuff down there, the salt seals up around it. And then you kind of do some of the science fiction that anti-nuclear people like to do. Well, what kind of signage do you put there? There was a huge set of meetings at Sandia. What kind of signage do you put over the WIP, the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, to warn future generations that there's something hot and dangerous half a mile down? And it was weird. They came up with, they're going to have these spiky things because, you know, the signs wouldn't do. They wouldn't speak English. They have these spiky, scary-looking things, and there'd be layers of hard to get through. Well, all of that would be so inviting to any aliens or future civilization. Wow, look at these beautiful spiky things. There must be something wonderful hidden down there. And so you'd just be inviting people. Well, what would they find? Not much. and it might be mildly damaging to the complete idiots that would dig a half mile down into a salt formation that has nothing in it but salt for 250 miles in every direction and almost a mile deep. They go into the middle of it and they find something, and the something there is got a little bit of harm left in it. I'm sorry. That's too bad for that idiot. I'm not willing to let the climate do the high route in order to protect that idiot. So we exaggerated the worries. I had exactly the feeling of we do not have the option of burdening future generations with our waste. What I came to realize, the burden that we are placing on future generations with our waste is carbon dioxide primarily, and methane to some extent. And the nuclear waste is microscopic as a burden on the future compared to those. I'd love to have it be nothing at all. I think there is reason that fusion will go ahead, which has basically no waste stream at all. But in the meantime, nuclear looks better than these other things.
We have run out of time for this week. Next week, we'll run more from this conversation with Stuart Brand, author of Whole Earth Discipline, an Eco-Pragmatist Manifesto. Find an online version of the book at this website, sbnotes.com. That's sbnotes.com. Brand is among those who have made a shift toward the unthinkable, massive construction of nuclear power to avert climate change, geoengineering to stop the heat until we can make that shift, genetically engineered food to help agriculture survive drought, floods, heat, or new insects, the big technical fix, almost the complete opposite of the do-it-yourself, localized mentality made famous in the 1970s Whole Earth Catalog. Why did Stuart Brand change, and how far did he go? Next week, we'll hear his verdict on the 1970s, everything from communal gardening to the sexual revolution, and his strange trust in his friends, the multi-billionaires he admires so much, almost as much as his changeable 90-year-old guru, Sir James Lovelock. Is ecopragmatism green at all? Will the technical big fix really heal the planet? Be sure and join us next week for more Stuart Brand and, finally, my comments. Meanwhile, I'd like to know what you think. Please send your comments on this program to this email address, radio@ecoshock.org. And keep your eye out on our climate change page next week for another big speech by Stuart Brand. Our Radio EcoShock show blog is at ecoshock.info, or download tons of free green audio MP3s at the website, ecoshock.org. Plus, I have a surprise guest next week, an example of what can go wrong when big business follows Stuart Brand's mantra of concentration. Our good friend Dana Pearson has been hard at work on a new short song for Radio EcoShock and for everyone who wants inspiration to save the planet from the climate shift. This one is called Deal With It, and we must. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening.
Climate is in trouble. Let's deal with it. Oh yeah. Ain't no time for denial. We've got to deal with it. The scientists are scared.
So scared.
And they're telling us it's real.
It's real.
So think about your children. And then tell me how you feel. Cause the planet trouble, so let's deal with it.
It's getting hotter out here.
Quit believing all them lies. Gotta deal with it. Think about tomorrow and the world you leave behind. So much pain and sorrow if you keep on acting blind. Cause the planet is in trouble
and it needs our help.
Let's deal with it
with solar energy.
The planet is in trouble.
God gave us the sun.
We gotta deal with it.
There's millions of jobs for everyone.
Yes, the planet is in trouble.
20 photovoltaics on every rooftop.
We gotta deal with it.
And electric cars in every garage.
The planet is in trouble.
Giant wind farms in the ocean.
We gotta deal with it.
Concentrating solar collectors in our deserts.
trouble.
Ocean farming and OPEC have nearly unlimited potential.
Up to it, people.
No more denial.